Station number 12246, Lieutenant Colonel W. Waitman, Reel 7.
Colonel W.A. Waitman, Reel 7. You mentioned joining the 2nd Battalion Durham Light Infantry, Colonel, at milestone 82. From whence was that measured?
The 82nd milestone, like other important milestones, lies on the road from Dibapur through Kohima and onto Imphal. And it is actually the Durham Battalion DLI were at the 82nd, which is 82 miles from Dibapur, lying between Kohima and Imphal. The battalion had been resting there since July, troops being sent on leave to India and reforming after the tremendous battle at Kohima, and finally 33rd Corps linking up with 4th Corps between Kohima and Imphal. The DLI Colonel, Colonel Brown, had been killed in the Battle of Kohima and replaced by Major Robinson, who was promoted Lieutenant Colonel from the Royal Berkshire Regiment, one of the sister battalions, along with the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, in 6th Brigade of 2 Div. Prior to my joining, Colonel Robinson had been posted back to command his own battalion of the Royal Berkshires, and he'd been superseded by Colonel Southey of the Essex Regiment, who was commanding 2 DLI. I had written to Colonel Southey from the British Base Reinforcement Camp at Dilali, and he'd written to General Headquarters India asking that I be posted to his battalion, as at that time he was 11 officers short. And I and others joined the battalion at different periods over the next 9 or 10 months. The morale was quite high. Certainly the battalion, along with others in the division and in other divisions of 4th Corps and 33rd Corps, had had heavy casualties of officers and all ranks, and brother officers had lost their friends, and soldiers had lost their chums and mates, and it had had a profound effect on them. But this, in fact, was the Kohima was the second blooding the Durhams had had, as 6th Brigade had gone up to the Arakan in 1942 and fought there in what was probably a draw. However, in the Kohima battle, it was definitely a victory for the 33rd Corps and the 4th Corps. And the Japs were on their way back, falling back through the hills and the monsoon back into Burma. From Imphal down to the main crossing of the Chinwin River in Burma at Kalewa, the 11th East African Division were pushing the Japanese rearguard back down the Kabul Valley towards Kalewa, with the ultimate aim of forcing the river there. My platoon was number 10 platoon of C Company, along with numbers 9 and 11 platoons. Each platoon consisted of a platoon headquarters and 3 rifle sections. My company commander was Major Tony Shuttle. His second in command was Captain Bill Smith, with whom I'm still in touch. I'm still in correspondence at Christmas time with Major Shuttle's widow, Reenie. And my platoon sergeant was Sergeant Gunn. Within a week of joining the platoon and getting run in with them. Training, the first day's training we did was tank infantry cooperation with the 3rd Dragoon Guards, Carbineers, up the road with close quarter training and tank liaison marrying up, indication of targets, tanks running over us in foxholes so that we got used to the armoured element in close support.
The tanks actually went over you, was it?
We just ducked down in foxholes and the tank trundled over the top.
And that was quite safe?
Oh, quite. Provided you keep down in the hole.
What kind of support was this? Were the tanks being used as a spearhead and the infantry following? What was the kind of routine that you followed?
No, to go in together so that the infantry were there, both the infantry company or platoon and their own covering troops. The 3rd Dragoon Guards had a company of the 4th Bombay Grenadiers as their close supporting troops. And this was for mutual protection, to avoid Japs coming up to the tanks with magnetic explosive, magnetic mines, which would be attached to the side, or boxes of explosive, and suicide parties going up underneath the tank. So you were there for mutual support, and they shot us in to targets which were bunkers and enemy positions. At this stage, of course, it was training, and no one was firing back. Within a week of taking over 10 Platoon, unfortunately, my sergeant, Gunn, was transferred on promotion to B Company as Company Sergeant Major. B Company had been commanded after the Battle of Kohima by a Canadian officer who was on a tour of the Far East from Europe, a Major Balachi, and he considered that the Sergeant Major Mick Welsh, known with a certain amount of affection and a certain amount of fear by the Geordies as Cushy Mick Welsh, because he was anything but cushy, Balachi didn't comprehend the British way of discipline and thought that Welsh was too severe on the soldiery. He had put a case up to Colonel Southey for Welsh to be transferred from the company and demoted, which Southey weakly, and we later saw more classic examples of this when we went into action, weakly concurred. And I was landed with a very disgruntled pre-war soldier, Sunderland man, Cushy Mick Welsh. He naturally was very upset by this, and it rubbed off, and in fact made him more prickly than ever. So for some while, there was a certain amount of aggro within the platoon through his strict discipline. Not that discipline was ever slack, but he tended just to go over the top, and I had to keep him in line. And whilst not actually being easygoing myself with the soldiery, just to keep a fair balance. But I'm happy to say that at a later date, in February the following year, which we'll come to in due course, he was promoted Company Sergeant Major of our company, and I deliberately went down to find him in the hedge where he was waiting prior to us crossing the Irrawaddy River in the February of the following year, and personally congratulated him on his promotion back to his rank, which he richly deserved.
Did you find this particularly difficult because you were relatively green at this time and he was somewhat of a veteran? Did he seem to resent this kind of attempt by you to keep him in line or bring him down?
There could have been. That may have crossed his mind. It certainly didn't cross mine. I had the pip on my shoulder. He had 3 chevrons. I was the boss. And there was never any doubt about that, either in the platoon, the company, or the battalion. And I led from the front then, and I've led from the front ever since. Now, my platoon order of battle, I was platoon commander, 2nd Lieutenant W.A. Waitman, platoon sergeant, Sergeant Mick Welsh. My batman was a miner from Eshwinning, Private Cyril Armitage. My runner, who was actually based at company headquarters to run from there to me with messages, was Private Jeff Cooper from Essex. And my own runner from me back to company headquarters was Private Vincent Kitching from Richmond, North Yorkshire. My number one on the mortar was Private Shiner Harrison from Annick. And my number two on the mortar was Corporal Dave Broughton from West Hartlepool. Number four section was commanded by a Londoner, Corporal Wright, and his 2IC had been a gunner, and as heavy ACAC regiments were disbanded and the chaps transferred to infantry, they adopted an infantry rank. But Bombardier Inch, Lance Bombardier Inch from Dagenham, was the 2IC of 4 section. Number one on the Bren was Private Joe Davis from Wingate County, Durham. His number two, Private Paddy O'Neill from Dublin. And then the soldieries, a very brave and popular little man, Private Charlie Husband from Chesley Street, the famous 446-5509 Private Husband C. Another gunner, ex-gunner, Private Tuffin, and then Privates Calderwood, Merton and Elwell. Number five section was commanded by a great Newcastle street fighter, Corporal Bobby Lowes of Bell Terrace in the old Newcastle. His 2IC, Lance Corporal Josh Jennings from South Shields. Private Kelly and Private Dearden, also from South Shields. And Private Johnson, Foggin, Old Jammer Jamerson from Blythe. Another O'Neill, but not from over the water this time. Private Graham and Private Nixon from Hexham. And number six section was commanded by a former Sherwood Forester instructor from the 52nd Training Brigade, where I had done my training, but from the Sherwood Foresters Battalion. And within a fortnight of myself joining 2DLI, I was pleased to get Corporal Ted Lindsay, who was an excellent soldier and weapon training instructor, and having done a lot of instruction in the jungle himself, wanted to get out and get into action. His 2IC was also a transferee from the Essex Regiment, Corporal Charlie Gardner from Walworth in London, Private Smith from Brummingham, Robertson, another Tynesider, Private Chris Pound, who was a Hull City policeman, and Private Hurst, Private George Hitchings, who'd been a gunner and transferred to the infantry and joined us in 2DLI, and Private Taffy Newman, who was down in my platoon roll book as a waiter. But I knew when I saw him digging his first foxhole on the east bank of the Chinwin that he'd been a coal miner who'd left South Wales and gone up to London when times were bad, boyo. And the number spare man on that section was Private Preston. Later on, during the campaign, there were inter-platoon and inter-company postings and chaps going on leave, being evacuated sick, transferred to other duties because they were unreliable in action, either through lack of moral fibre or just plain shit scared. We were all readily admit to being frightened ourselves on most of the occasions, but some were more windy than others and just had to be got rid of, as very bad apples could infect the rest and produce a disaster.
We are told to keep a sharp eye on people who displayed this kind of tendency.
Some were already known, and some occurred as we went along, and we weeded them out. On the other hand, it produced a knock-on effect, and when we were at Yazagio, the medical officer, who I'm still very friendly with, Captain Teddy Havard Jones, was going round the platoons, checking on health and morale in general. And he said to little Charlie Husband, "How are you today, Husband?" He said, "Well, I'm all right, sir, but I'm so-and-so upset because there's so many people getting cushy jobs on the airstrip these days, I thought I'd try to get one myself."
Were these basically a veteran brunch by the time you got them?
Most of them, a good 50%. Had been in action at Kohima. But some, like me, were and the gunners were new and reinforcements. And some, such as Sergeant Welsh and Armitage and the older men, they'd been in the Arakan and then Kohima. But Jennings and others had been on the same troop ship that I'd been on, Her Majesty's Transport Multan, between September and October 1943, and we remembered each other by name or by sight from the month on the troop ship.
How did men coming from another regiment settle into, in this particular case, of course, the Dolomite Infantry? Because that tended at times to cause problems, didn't it?
A little difficult to start with, and it depended on how they fitted in with their mates or their new mates and the new commander. Quite a few of these chaps, such as Corporal Wright and Corporal Gardner and Cooper, had come from the Essex Regiment, but battle had bonded them at Kohima. And the original Durhams were getting diluted by Essex and gunners, and of course Durhams were being sent to other battalions in the division, particularly during the Battle of Kohima, to make up casualties. A school day friend of mine, a chap slightly older, I noticed his name in the nominal roll book at our company, the base reinforcement camp at Dullarley, Private Donald Beaton. And I'd sent him a letter and said, I'll look forward to seeing you again after all these years when I join the battalion in a couple of months' time. But unbeknown to me, he was already dead, having been killed at Arradura Spur with the Royal Scots. I found that he'd been killed, but learnt within the last 4 or 5 years at the two Div Kohima weekends where he actually fell in action.
You mentioned gunners there. How were they taken from their original experience and role into an infantry?
As the threat of Jap air raids receded almost completely on air raids on Calcutta, and there had been the odd raid on Madras in the southeast of India, then the heavy and medium ACAC units were disbanded, and they did a month's jungle training, and then up to the reinforcement camps. Camilla, the main one, number 23 reinforcement camp, and then probably through two others on the riverside at Pandu and Gohati. That was 32 and 34 reinforcement camps of Southeast Asia Command. Later on, when Wingate's Chindits, or the Special Forces they were called, were disbanded in 1945, we got reinforcements in the April of 1945 from the Royal Leicestershire Regiment. And having had experience in Burma themselves, and certainly not of hard training, they blended in well with us. We were jolly pleased to see them. But we were soon to be forged together ourselves in action. After roughly a month at the 82nd milestone, the battalion made a night exit from the 82nd milestone by motor transport to Imphal.
Before we go any further, Colonel, could I ask you, what was the health state of the battalion when you arrived?
Quite satisfactory. Deep trench latrines on the hillside, corrugated iron and timber, cookhouse and dining accommodation. Some of the dining accommodation were tarpaulin stretched over trees, but the camp was spotless, small volleyball pitch and extensive training. When you climb 2,000 or 3,000 feet up the Cuds in the morning, the villages at the top, Conyum and the like, and then down the other side and up again another Cud side, well, you're as fit as fire.
Supplies will be coming through to you, obviously, of all kinds. How were they getting to you?
Through the line of communication, LFC, the Manipur Road, from Dimapur through Kohima to Imphal and beyond, because the 14th Army had got 11th East African Division pushing down the Cabor Valley, and the troops were in the Tamu Palel Imphal Plain, the famous Imphal Plain. Of course, the Royal Air Force were there in strength as well, too. When we moved off on a night vehicle movement from the 82nd milestone and reached Imphal just before daylight, passed through there and staged overnight at Palel.
What date was this, Colonel?
At the end of November 1944. And then from Palel we drove on and staged overnight just off the track at Tamu. Once we left Imphal, of course, the road was just track all the way. About, 10 or 12 yards wide and just soil. Mutty, as it's known as in India. And then from Tamu we motored on the third day and arrived at Yazagyo in the Cabor Valley, where it was extensively teak forest. Cabor Valley was known as Death Valley because so many refugees had perished there, fleeing from the Japanese in the Burma advance of 1942, our retreat, the Japanese advance. And we waited there for about a fortnight, forming up, waiting for the East African Division to get a foothold on the east bank of the Chindwin, which they did at Kalewa. So, in the second week of December, we moved again from Yazagyo by road down the track to Ijingali. And Ijingali lies 18 miles west of the major crossing point at Kalewa of the Chinwin River.
Had the terrain changed from where you'd started?
Hills to the left, but we were keeping down the valley, Cabor Valley all the way, and then turn left to head for Kalewa. And having debusted Ijingali, we marched and did a 8 to 10 hour halt at Waya Chong on the bank of the Matinj River. And when darkness fell, we moved off on our approach to Kalewa. That was quite an exasperating march because, for whatever reason, we kept going a few hundred yards or even 20 or 30 yards, then having to halt and wait for a few minutes and then on again. But we eventually reached this longest Bailey Bridge in the world across the Chinwin at Kalewa to move into the 11th East African Division bridgehead. We crossed in darkness and dispersed in all-round a fence around some Burmese temples. And when daylight came, we prepared to move on. I noticed in the long grass the wreck of a Dakota aircraft, but I don't know how long it had been there, whether it had been shot down in 1944 or earlier.
Was there many other signs of fighting that had gone on ahead of you?
Very little. In some of the straw bashes, we occasionally found Japanese skeletons, which had been left behind as they withdrew through the monsoon after the defeat at Kohima and Imphal. And the only sign of war was first light, because the Sten machine carbine at that time had no safety device, and if it was bumped or knocked, the bolt had only to move back the length of a round, which it fed, and it fired automatically. So the number of shots going off at stand to and first light on our first morning over the Chinwin River, one would think that there was a Japanese attack coming in. So eventually the CO had to introduce punishment of 7 days' pay for people letting accidental discharge of their Sten's machine carbine, which was gravely dangerous to our own troops, as we were to find out at a later date.
Were you standing two on each of the mornings that you came?
Every morning you stood two, and every evening you stood two, before last light at night and into last light, and then before first light the following morning. We then set off marching down the side of the Chinwin River to Shwe Gin, where the track swings eastwards towards central Burma. And when we staged there, we did get a swim in the Chinwin, which was very good to get the dust from the track off our bodies. One's boots kicked up enough dust, but passing vehicles, although they went slowly, tended to shower one with dust. We then moved forward and had an early Christmas meal about a week before Christmas near Schwegin. And there were some of the relics of the British retreat from 1942. And Private Tuffin, who'd been Gunner Tuffin, recognised some of their own anti-aircraft guns, which had to leave behind by the roadside. Suitably rendered in service, of course, and the Japanese had left them where they stood as they passed by on their advance into India.
Did you keep the same order of march all the way through this time, or was there some kind of switching round of leading companies?
Each company... Companies rotated in the lead, but we were still within the 11th East African Division perimeter, because they had pushed on eastwards. This had caused some resentment, so we heard, because we heard on the grapevine that they'd been told to establish a bridgehead at Calais, where then they were told to push on a bit further down to Schwegin, then a bit further. So eventually we reached the limit of their perimeter quite well to the east of the Chinwin, at Chongzon. We then pushed forward with the Royal Berkshires in the lead and the supported by the 3rd Carbineers Lee tanks to Pinjin, where a large wadi runs from north east to southwest and eventually runs into the Chinwin River. That wadi, of course, was dry as the monsoon had ended, so it was quite a large strip of sand. And having pushed forward from Pinjin, the pace slowed as the Berkshires probed forward towards a feature called the Wangyo Gorge, which was the limit of the lower hills and the jungle before breaking out of the central Burma plain. And it was anticipated, and we were proved correct, that the Japs would try to hold that to delay us getting out from the jungle into the central plain. And just before Christmas, near the beginning of the Wangyo Gorge, when the seer of the Royal Berkshires, Colonel Robinson, his second in command, Major Frankie Boschel, and the tank squadron commander, Major Huntley Wright, were discussing the next bound forward, the next forward probe of the Berkshires, and the leading troop of tanks, they were looking over a map with a Jap machine gunner not very far away, and he hit all three. Major Huntley Wright was killed outright. The other two were wounded. Lieutenant Don Good of the Royal Engineers went to drag in the wounded and was wounded himself. But other Berkshires scrambled them to safety, and Colonel Robinson, Frankie Boschel, and Don Good lived to tell the tale, but were out for some while, considerable while, several months. Sadly, Major Huntley Wright was killed. And that was the 23rd of December 1944.
Was this the first action that the division had come into?
That was our first contact in the drive for Mandalay. And it was the beginning of what General Nicholson, our division commander, told us as we left Yazagio. We're now going on what may prove to be a very great adventure.
Were you being told, or were you just expected to kind of deal with the change in Japanese tactics? Had you been in any way told that what they might do in this retreating situation? Or was that something to find out through experience?
We thought that they would hold longer than they did. In fact, we moved forward, the shooting went on, and for 3 days thereafter. And on Boxing Day, of December 1944. The Derhams slipped through the Berkshires, and we as C Company were the leading company. 11 platoon leading, followed by company commanders O Group, myself and a Lieutenant Dyer, who joined us as a reinforcement 10 days earlier. And we moved along the track, again about 8 to 10 yards wide, which crossed over wooden bridges over this winding Sipadon Chong. And when we were about half a mile before leaving the gorge, we came under machine gun fire from a position immediately to our front. The bursts missed 11 platoon. Unfortunately, the platoon commander, Lieutenant Kit Corner, who was again a converted gunner officer, spotted the NIT position up on a ridge to the right of the road. They moved forward, covered by my platoon, and Lieutenant Corner took a section up the reverse slope of the ridge.